Welcome back to this special Think Tank edition of Prostate Cancer Update. Dr. Paul Shellhammer reviewed an older topic, but one with much greater meaning now that the data on PSA doubling time are available. Specifically, the important issue of whether complete androgen blockade provides a therapeutic advantage over monotherapy.
Depending upon the era of discussion or the mindset of the discussant, a review of CAB can either be viewed with enthusiasm or with a significant amount of pessimism. And the enthusiasm began in 1989 with 0036. In 2000, the Prostate Cancer Trialist Collaborative Group did a meta-analysis, and when non-steroidal antiandrogens were used, and that was flutamide and nilutamide available at that time, there was a five-year survival benefit of 2.9% in the patients receiving CAB. CAB with bicalutamide was not tested against monotherapy because the drug wasn't available through FDA approval at the time, but this trial did randomize two different CAB constructs, namely one using bicalutamide and one flutamide. Over 800 patients with metastatic disease were randomized to one versus the other CAB arm. And there was a trend to benefit in survival for the patients who had been on the bicalutamide CAB arm versus the flutamide CAB arm. No single trial as of yet analyzed using CAB bicalutamide, but there is one in process now in Japan, and preliminary data shows an advantage in PSA progression and progression to hormone refractory disease, much too immature for survival. The issue of cost has always been brought up with regard to CAB, specifically with regard to addition of the antiandrogen. This has been analyzed in this particular analysis by Dave Penson, and it shows a overall quality adjusted and overall per year of life gain that's very reasonable within the construct of what we accept from renal dialysis and renal failure patients is roughly $40,000 to $50,000 per year, so it falls well into that algorithm. Now, we discussed earlier with regard to the advantages of benefit and how much of a benefit is meaningful clinically as well as statistically. And I just point out here the benefit of CAB versus castration monotherapy with regard to median survival in patients with androgen-dependent disease and compare it with the taxotere-mitoxanthrone trial in androgen-independent disease with regard to relative benefits, essentially in this very same ballpark. And we've already discussed this particular issue, namely the absolute benefits of polychemotherapy in women with breast cancer being felt to be appropriate in a range of absolute percentage gain that is virtually identical to the CAB versus monotherapy survival percentage gain at 5 years for patients with prostate cancer. Just a couple of words about second-line hormone therapy. One that I think is relatively underused is ketoconazole. We're all familiar with it. It's not FDA approved for the use of prostate cancer, blocks steroid synthesis, lowers both adrenal and testicular androgens, has perhaps direct cytotoxic effect, important to administer appropriately, namely without food, without H2 blockers, preferably with orange juice or Coke because of the acid necessity for absorption. Unfortunately, sometimes this results in some of the GI upset that occurs in conjunction with the medication. It's been used in 200 to 400 milligram Q8-hour dosing. I think there's evidence now to state that the 200 is equally effective as the 400 and probably causes less GI toxicity. It's given in conjunction with hydrocortisone. The incidence of PSA fall is 70 to 80 to 90%. This should be in 50% of patients, so a reasonable response. Duration of response in median, not relatively impressive, but occasionally patients do extraordinarily well for a prolonged period of time. I'll close with a sad note with regard to a trial that would have been extraordinarily helpful in determining the role of second-line hormone therapy in patients with non-metastatic rising PSA disease that was constructed to accrue almost 600 patients, but because of the dismal accrual was closed, and I think the opportunity for an important question answered was lost.
Thanks, Paul. What's your take, Dave, on the issue of MAB and whether or not it ought to be offered to patients in clinical practice and in what situations?
I think MAB is the gold standard. It has plenty of data from large randomized phase 3 trials to support it. What do you call that, level 1 evidence? If you look at our trials right now, when we're using hormone therapy, we're using MAB. Casodex has less side effects. Biclutamide has less side effects than flutamide. We know that. Even Dr. Eisenberger's study, that was a SWOG study that he was privileged to be the PI on, showed a 10% benefit to combine androgen blockade. So almost every study out there shows a benefit. None of them show negative. It just depends on how you put it. And then to answer your question, in whom, I think clearly in people with metastatic disease, there's a reason to give that. I think that flare is an issue in some people. Blocking the flare is important. That the concept about combined androgen blockade goes beyond flare, goes to adrenal androgens and things like that. So I strongly believe in it.
Tom?
I would echo what Davis said. I also feel that a lot of these studies, all of them, are old. All of them deal with a group of patients that we've discussed today we rarely see. A lot of these patients were treated at the time when we had no knowledge of the anti-androgen withdrawal effect. A lot of them were treated with more advanced disease. And if you look at the old, as regards PSA dropping down to 4 nanograms per mil, I think that's not a nadir. If you look at the Dykeman, or the old Yanknet study, which was published about a year before, that showed that, and it wasn't flutamide, it was nilutamide, an orchiectomy, that patients who nadired down their PSAs to less than 0.5 had a 7-month statistically significant survival advantage in heavy volume metastatic disease. And for all those reasons, I think MAB, or whatever you want to call it, we've probably underestimated the effect. We probably mistreated most of the patients. And if you have somebody who you're going to put on an LHRH agonist, I would recommend putting them on MAB because I don't think we truly know the value of it in today's setting.
Laurie?
The real problem in this area, I think, is that it relates more to how we use hormonal therapy in general than the MAB question. It's very clear that we have been too aggressive in treating patients with hormonal therapy for PSA failure who really weren't at risk. The patients who, in retrospect, we didn't have the data earlier, but who have a late PSA relapse with a long PSA doubling time, these patients have a low risk of prostate cancer mortality. We have been treating them as a community, and to get excited about MAV versus monotherapy in patients who don't need treatment makes no sense, and I think that issue has made this a lot harder to tease out. I think now that we can identify the patients who are at high risk for progression, the kind of data that Stephen presented makes it very clear who should have aggressive hormonal therapy with MAB, which is the patients who have metastatic disease, as Dave said, and the ones with PSA failure who look like they have metastatic disease in terms of their natural history.
Just to echo exactly that, I think that's an excellent point. And if you actually look in our study, there were a quarter of the patients, 82 patients, that had a delayed recurrence and a doubling time greater than 15 months. And in the absence of radiation, in the absence of early hormonal therapy, prostate cancer survival at 15 years was 100% in that group. And that was a quarter of our patients.
Paul?
My first question may have not been as precise as it should have been. I said, do you agree with the benefits of MAB, yes or no? Since half the physicians disagreed, is there anybody who would speak against MAB in a patient then with metastatic disease? I should have been more specific and said, in patients with M1 disease, is MAB standard of care or monotherapy?
I wouldn't speak to it, but I can tell you, I mean, the zeitgeist out there, and I have heard medical oncologists and urologists and others say, well, we know, look at the MAB story, a useless therapy, and we were deceived for 10 years. So, I mean, I hear that all the time. The general sense out there is that it does not make a difference in terms of survival.
In our patterns of care study, we see, I think, maybe 40-50% of people using it, but a lot of people not utilizing it. Jerry?
Yeah, I think that, not to be critical here, but the message that came out of Hopkins in response to the MAB thing and the PETO analysis has just changed the attitude of so many people. They have looked at it and said, it really doesn't do very much, not worth it, it's not worth the expense, patients can't afford it. And I think it's really unfortunate because the benefit's greater than it is with Taxotere, and everyone's excited about Taxotere. So I think that there is a problem about the misperception in that setting. Now, the truth is we don't have a lot of patients that qualify, but now we have this other group here of patients who must have metastatic disease, that they're doubling in less than 3 months and dying within 5 to 6 years. They have to have metastatic disease to be doing that. And the challenge for us is, how do you counsel or what do you say to people where we can't prove they've got metastatic disease other than the fact that they're acting like they're going to die very quickly? Do we go back to that and say, look, you're clearly in trouble. The best thing we can offer you is maximum blockade. We can't recommend it because we don't have proof that you have metastatic disease. Maybe we should start being more aggressive about how we prove whether or not they've got early metastasis if we can't use the PSA as a surrogate.
Howard?
I'm totally confused by what you said.
What I'm saying is maximum blockade gives you the best chance for survival when you've got metastatic disease.
Okay.
Treating earlier metastatic disease is better. And we have a parameter that is identifying people who are acting like they have metastasis, but we can't prove they have metastasis other than this PSA doubling time. Shouldn't we be aggressively using hormone therapy, maximum blockade, in that setting?
Yeah, that's fine.
Do you agree with that?
I think those patients need systemic therapy, and the standard for that patient is maximal blockade. As far as we know.
Yeah, but he just said only 40% of the community people are of the belief that that's true.
And all
the data
is
the data. I mean,
Mario.
The question is still open, what the contribution of maximal blockade will be in that very high-risk patient who doesn't have the greatest hormone sensitivity. But you've already seen the predictive value of not achieving a PSA nadir, and you know you have a higher... What I'm curious is how do you reconcile the maximal blockade data with what's been evolving in terms of intermittent therapy, which suggests that it's not worse than if you have periods where the testosterone is allowed to recover, it's not detrimental. Now, granted, the final survival analysis is not done, but the inferences on the preliminary data that's been supported is that it's no worse. Is that fair?
It would be interesting to see if there's been a shift in the pattern of practice since the Medicare Prescription Drug Act has come forth, because one of the perceptions was the oral medications were too expensive to give to a lot of elderly patients. So I wonder if that's actually shifted at all in the last year or so, if there's been actually more antiandrogens prescribed or not, now that these drugs are more readily available.
So maybe you could ask you a question. Why wouldn't you do it?
Exactly.
You don't add toxicity that's significant.
It's cheap.
You have... Granted, with all the limitations of subset analysis, it never comes out worse when you use an antiandrogen. So if you want to maximize somebody's response, what's the problem?
Greg?
I'd like to just emphasize Lori's point. I think CAB got a bad name because we were throwing it at everybody, people that the local urologist knew you had 10 years to live. I think now that we have stratification, we can show the death rate within 5 years, that CAB will be very well accepted for this subset of patients.
Steve?
I think also part of the confusion comes in if you look at the data on cipritone acetate that actually worsened survival. So some of the early meta-analysis from the prostate cancer trial cooperative that came out in the Lancet in the late 1990s actually showed really no benefit, no statistical benefit. And that's kind of the era I was coming up in urology. I remember as a med student saying, okay, combined androgen blockade doesn't add anything. And then some of the reanalysis taking the cipritone acetate data, which is a steroidal antiandrogen rather than the bicalutamide, the non-steroidal, taking that out of the equation, you can start to see some modest benefit. And so I think that clouds the
picture. I've been saying that from the beginning because it's a steroidal antiandrogen. Same thing with megase. That they have estrogen-like side effects, and that negates it, and they're not complete blockade.
But I'm not sure all the community urologists are necessarily aware of that. If they just looked at the original Lancet paper from 1997 and read, it's a overall no benefit. So
I think that when we talk about total androgen blockade, we need to evaluate what happened. And I think the basic concept that the prostate cancer cells will adapt to very low levels of testosterone is an interesting concept. To some degree, it's probably correct. In 1983, we were told that we were curing patients with total androgen blockade. So we do the first trial, and we hit the jackpot. I was a co-author. I was a second author on this. And then we did a second trial, and I designed it. That's why I was a PI, and that's not because anyone did my favor. But nonetheless, that study was twice as big. We wanted to actually look at a 25% improvement, just what we saw in intergroup 0036, and we were not able to reject the null hypothesis, and that was a negative trial. So then everybody said, well, yeah, but it was a 10% difference. But the study was not designed to test the 10% difference. So the question is, do we design a study to test the 10% difference? Remember, in 1983, we were curing it, and today we are all talking about making a 10% difference. But now, let me finish, please. I'm not saying that the antiandrogens don't have a role. I think the interesting thing is that by treating somebody with standard gonadal ablation alone, we may actually see which patients may benefit by the addition of an antiandrogen, and probably is going to be a small proportion of patients because overall it doesn't make a huge difference in terms of outcome. But we may select the 15 or 25% of the patients whose PSA doesn't go down by 6 months or starts going up, and then we add an antiandrogen in that setting. So the trial that I would perhaps consider doing now, which is very difficult, is to use a combined androgen blockade versus a sequential gonadal ablation followed by second line by the addition of Casodex. But the reality is that the key issue is that the antiandrogens are really not an answer. They do have more side effects. The flutamide data suggests that it worsens the quality of life. It's over $300 a month that patients need to come out of their pocket. Is everybody going to have to do that up front? I don't. I use Casodex as second treatment in that fashion. Dave?
One thing we're forgetting. Do we really have strong evidence that orchiectomy is equivalent to LHRH agonist?
Yes.
Is there some... No, you don't.
No, you don't.
Yeah. Is there... Something else going on, okay? Could LHRH agonists have effect on the cell level? And there are LHRH receptors that inhibit cell growth. Gary Miller was working on this and a number of other people. You know, there may be something else that goes on here. The only trial to answer Dr. Chodak's question was Brian Peeling's trial in the UK years ago with 347 people on it comparing orchiectomy to monthly Zoladex. I would submit that that trial size of 150-some people on an arm is not sufficient to provide equivalence. Then there was a trial that some guy named Chodak and Vogelzang were involved with in the U.S. that took 10 years to get published, I think, a long time. It was orchiectomy and Zoladex, but in 200-some patients that showed equivalence. So we don't have large trials that say that it's equivalent. So maybe there is something there, and that's why the SWOG trial... You know, that the anti-androgen was able to boot it up a little bit. I don't know. And then there was the argument about flare and lots of other things. So, you know, I think there are a lot of legitimate questions that still remain, unfortunately. I mean, we need a big study of orchiectomy versus LHRH. We need a DES study. You know, lots of studies we need.
Laurie?
Well, just keep in mind, the data on bicalutamide suggests, first, the Japanese data is really strongly positive. And that is just LHRH plus or minus bicalutamide, 40% hazard ratio of 0.4.
200 patients.
80 milligrams.
Fine, it's 200 patients. It's strongly positive because the difference is so large. So all I'm arguing is that 10% relative difference is for the first generation. The estimate is a 20% benefit with bicalutamide, and it hasn't been tested other than in that Japanese trial.